You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the gloves come off, and not before time, as Donald Trump's remaining opponents finally stop pretending that the retired game show host can't win. But have Rubio and Cruz left it too late? My guests Michael Goldfarb and James Schneider will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Italy gets with the program, sort of, about same-sex marriage. Egypt refuses to get with the program, very much so, about elementary freedom of expression, and FIFA elects a new president whose many immediate problems do not include a tough act to follow. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are the author and journalist Michael Goldfarb and the senior correspondent of New African magazine, James Schneider. Welcome both back to Midori House. Now, first of all, it is traditional among right-thinking people to decry the tendency of modern politics to descend into partisan rancor, pantomime knockabout and intemperate name-calling. However, where Donald Trump's increasingly less improbable run for the Republican nomination is concerned, many have been wishing that his opponents would cease being delicate about Trump's manifold shortcomings. Last night, that fond wish was granted at the last GOP debate before Super Tuesday, as the rest of the field unloaded on the target-rich environment that is Trump's life and works. But is it too late, Michael Goldfarb?
I don't know. For the coming Super Tuesday, which is this Tuesday coming, yes. I mean, whatever impression Marco Rubio, who was the chief mugger on the stage last night, may have made, and may have, whoever he's managed to persuade that he's the man to take on Trump and ultimately be the Republican nominee, there's not enough time for that to percolate through to the electorate. But probably not. I mean, at the moment, there's a very, very useful thing in the Washington Examiner, which, if you're a real American political junkie, you can go for, by Byron York, who's making quite a name for himself as a pundit in this phase of the election. And he notes that Rubio's been saying, look, all of these primaries that Trump has won, they aren't winner-take-all. And the idea is to get delegates to the national convention to nominate you. So he's won these things, and it's been a surprise, but the delegates have been divvied up amongst everyone based on their vote share. But starting on Super Tuesday and then carrying on to the 15th of March, we start getting into the winner-take-all states. And Marco Rubio's people are saying, well, look, when it comes to winner-take-all, Marco's going to suddenly overtake Trump. But Byron York points out, if you haven't won yet, what makes you think you're going to start winning on March 15th? And I think that people are too busy, have been too busy throughout, saying, oh, well, Trump's ceiling is 30% of the Republican Party. Now it's 35%. It's 40%. The truth is nobody knows what his ceiling is. And I'm beginning to get the sense that the party elders are thinking, well, Trump can win. Trump can beat Hillary Clinton, who's still the likely Democratic nominee. And what they want more than anything is a win. They don't care who does the winning. And I think in that respect, it may be too late for a guy like Marco Rubio.
Well, one person who appears to have made the calculation that he doesn't care who wins, it's just about the winning, is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. In some breaking news just as we went to air, he has endorsed Donald Trump, James Schneider. Are we going to do the jokes about this being a heavyweight nominee, et cetera, et cetera? Clearly not, judging by that reaction. Is this a big deal?
I think it is. It's someone who is an establishment candidate who's got some sort of level of governing credibility, his possible VP running mate, and also who laid into Rubio very, very heavily before the New Hampshire primary. So it does give Trump a bit of credibility, and perhaps it's a bit of the establishment hedging their bets. Actually, if you'd see the attacks that Rubio made, a lot of them against Trump were really quite populist. They weren't the kind of traditional Republican establishment things. Lots of things about offshoring of jobs, things about Trump's business practices, which actually quite a lot of the Republican elite would be fairly comfortable with, the use of bankruptcy law. It's, you know, relatively normal business practice. But it does show that the Republican establishment perhaps are hedging their bets, as Michael was saying, and they're probably going to have to.
Michael, what do you think? Chris, this will be a huge talking point over the next 24 hours. As James suggests, it does appear a fairly transparent pitch for the VP slot by Chris Christie, who is doubtless calculating that Trump will need to balance the ticket by putting somebody, you know, sane and qualified on it.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that are there any Republicans in the national frame who are sane and qualified? Look, Chris Christie...
Everything's relative.
No, I mean, in some ways, it would unbalance stick. I mean, traditionally, you reach out and pick a running mate who can deliver you, or hopefully deliver you, a section of the country that you can't reach because, you know, Donald Trump is from New York, so he might reach out to someone from the Southwest or from down south. Whereas Chris Christie is from just across the Hudson River in Jersey. And, you know, it would just be one more surreal twist in an exceptionally surreal time to have two guys from either side of the Hudson River who really, really read to the nation as being from New York and North Jersey. And I don't know. Plus, I mean, what would Bruce Springsteen say? He's out on the road now, touring with the river. He's doing the river as his show. And you know something? If you listen to the river and listen to those songs of despair, not the rock out anthems.
It is a mixed bag, that record.
The songs of despair were aimed at people, and this is written in the late 70s, who have been completely bypassed by the last 35 years of American economic life. And I would wager that a fair number of Donald Trump's supporters, when they were 30, listened to the river and said, "This is the story of my life." And now they're angry, and they forgot about Bruce, and they're voting for Trump.
Well, I think we can surmise that Chris Christie, who is a tragic Bruce Springsteen fan, has blown his chances of another backstage pass forever and ever and ever. James, to return to Trump, has anything been tried as a means of attack that hasn't been? I know there's that conventional wisdom that foreign affairs don't win elections, but would there be any mileage in just reminding Republican voters that the rest of the world would fall about laughing at the idea of a President Donald Trump? We just this week had, or today, in fact, former President Vicente Fox of Mexico has said in what we will charitably describe as no uncertain terms that if Donald Trump wants a wall, he can pay for it himself.
No, I don't think it will put them off. The US electorates don't necessarily care that much what the rest of the world thinks or knows that much necessarily about what the rest of the world thinks. I think the problem for the rest of the Republicans, if Trump wins, and though the attacks that, actually I'm going to start from somewhere else, the attacks that might actually work against him, which will be the attacks that the Democrats will run against him regardless of who their candidate is, if he's the Republican candidate, are counter him with the populist arguments, the sort of arguments that Rubio was actually putting out yesterday, which you can put out with a Democrat spin rather than a right-wing Republican spin, but it's pretty much the same argument that this is a job offshorer, a complete elite, blah blah blah. You know, he inherited $200 million. These arguments could work, and if they stick to him because the Republicans hit him with them, and then he becomes their nominee, it might actually make it easier for the Democrats to defeat him.
Okay, well, we will doubtless have ample further opportunity to discuss Donald Trump and the Republican contest. But for now, we will look at Rome, to where a tempered measure of credit is due. In the context of Western Europe, Italy has been dragging its feet vis-a-vis same-sex marriage. It's the last major country in Western Europe to disdain even civil partnerships. The Italian Senate has now passed a bill which will allow civil unions, rather, for same-sex and indeed heterosexual couples. It still needs to pass the lower house. And among those actually unthrilled by it are gay activists, who are quite reasonably infuriated by the removal of a clause which would have permitted same-sex couples to adopt children. Michael, if we're trying to be optimistic here, should we at least be thinking of this as a tentative step in the right direction?
Yes, and you also have to remember that Italy is still the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church. And even though the Pope is perhaps more liberal on this than any of his predecessors, it's an odd country, Italy, as you know, Andrew. And I don't mean odd in an unpleasant way. I mean, it is one of those places where when we go as tourists and enjoy, you know, it's as cosmopolitan as London, and you think, well, of course everybody agrees, you know, and being gay is nothing. I mean, it is as it is in London, you know, whatever. But then there is that half of the country where it is so out of the question that it may be necessary to take it in steps. I mean, even in the United States, things went in steps, you know, from civil partnerships and then state-by-state marriage. And look, and as my Italian friends will tell you, Italy is barely a country. You know, it's only 150 years old, the unification of Italy, 170 years now. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, you have to go region by region, and if you're going to legislate nationally, it is possible that this step has to be taken. You know, if you take moral rights, this is my point, I'm sorry, I don't mean to digress too far. The minute you take moral rights and put them into the legislative process is about compromise, and you often end up with a loaf that is only half-baked, and you have to put it back in the oven later.
It is, of course, James, a very difficult thing to tactfully say to people who've been waiting for fairly fundamental human freedoms and rights for far too long as it is, that they must just be patient and it will all be okay eventually. But looking, I guess, at a wider context, is it, in the developed world at least, is it complacent at this point, do you think, to say that the momentum on this issue is irreversible, that it is all going one way, and maybe not even 20 years from now people will just be saying, was this ever a thing people were worried about?
I think it is irreversible, and I don't think anyone is just saying, just be patient, there's, you know, the tide is going in the way, going this way. These things do go in steps. That doesn't mean that people demobilize after having a win. In the UK, we had civil partnerships first, and it actually took quite a long time, but that the gap between civil partnerships and equal marriage, there was a sea change in public opinion going in that direction. It took some political leadership to catch up with actually how social views had changed. And perhaps that's what's happening now in Italy. Renzi's shown a high degree of leadership, and we might see over the next 5 years what is now not equal marriage, but civil unions sort of spreading out and percolating through society and it becoming normalized, and then it will become incredibly easy for them to pass the equal marriage if people keep on agitating for it.
Michael, you, as you correctly pointed out, Italy does, you know, enclose the Vatican City, the headquarters of the Catholic Church. But, I mean, other Catholic countries in Europe, France, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, have all got eventually quite cheerfully on board with this. Is it just the sort of that intimate relationship of the Catholic Church to Italy, or is Italy a special case for other reasons?
Well, I think that Italy is, I do think it is the Catholic Church. And again, it's a very odd relationship that Italians have with the Catholic Church in the modern era. And on a Sunday in La Marche, which is where I like to go if I have enough money in my pocket for a holiday in the summer, like every other year, come a Sunday, people don't go to church. The Pope gets sick, you've got 3 million people standing in St. Peter's Square. Now, not all of them are regular churchgoers. It is the life of the church itself. The Vatican may be a separate entity, but it is intimately bound up with the Italian sense of their nation. It's very hard to pick the two apart. And so I suppose that the deeply conservative nature of the church, which is only just beginning to shift in these last few years of the current Pope's pontificate, it takes a lot to unpick that. Those decades of, you know, John Paul and then his successor, Cardinal Ratzinger, who was Pope Benedict. You know, they were men of deeply conservative nature. And let's face it, they were anti-gay.
Well, among their sympathisers still is clearly Senator Roberto Calderoli of the Northern League, who said that all those who vote yes today will end up in hell, which is, you know, a point of view. You know where the man stands. But on that front, James, is when the religious objections get floated, whether they are by the actual church or by people attempting to speak on the church's behalf, do you think they are just sincerely religious objections, or are these religious entities attempting to cling on to what power they still have by reinforcing these views?
I think it's both. I mean, sometimes these become shibboleths and they're about the identity of an institution. I think that's certainly it. And you can see that with how easily they get given away. I mean, so the Lega Nord is a far-right party. I think that in 20 years' time, they will be doing the same thing as the English Defence League do here, which is supporting gay rights in order to beat up on another grouping in society. And in some ways, that will demonstrate the success of the movement. And I think that's what we will end up seeing. Sadly, because the Lega Nord aren't going to go away and they've still got people they want to beat up on in society.
On that happy thought, we are going to take a short break. Now, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and James Schneider. Coming up next, with tedious inevitability, Egypt begins locking up the writers.
Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference returns this April for 3 days of great conversations, inspiring panellists and peerless hosting. Set in Vienna, the conference will pull together people who care about running better businesses, brands, design studios, cities and even nations, and who are looking for global inspiration and new benchmarks for success. Up for discussion will be the future of communication in a world overwhelmed by digital content, how to make a nation. Monocle is launching this brand new book in Austria and will be bringing some star names from diplomacy, government and business to explain how good countries can deliver on quality of life for all. And we'll hear from players from around the globe who've discovered that you can create jobs and wealth with downtown ateliers and the sound of the odd hammer. Speakers such as chef and food writer Bill Granger, co-founder and director of Vienna Design Week Lily Holein, and the journalist and writer Gianni Riotta will share the stage with Monocle's editors and many, many more. Running from Friday afternoon to Sunday, with a focus on a full Saturday schedule, the conference is designed as a live event with elements broadcast here on Monocle 24. In between the debates, there'll be plenty of time to meet the editors, speakers, sponsors, and also your fellow readers and listeners. For more information and tickets, visit monocle.com. Be part of the discussion at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2016 from April 15th to the 17th. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Michael Goldfarb and James Schneider. Now, it's not news that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi of Egypt remains unpersuaded of the merits of free expression. Outside his own country, his best-known signature policy remains the imprisoning of three Al Jazeera reporters for the crime of reporting things. It might be argued that this was at least a strategically logical shot across the bows of Qatar. It's harder to make much case for the means by which Egypt's compliant judiciary have decided to fill the cells eventually vacated by the Al Jazeera 3. Novelist Ahmed Naji has just been given 2 years on charges of violating public modesty. This follows the jailings of other public figures on similarly vague and silly charges, mostly to do with defaming religious symbols. Michael, do we have much in the way of idea what violating public modesty means, other than whatever General al-Sisi decides it does?
I think it's along those lines. I don't know much, because the regime, since they jailed the Al Jazeera 3, has become less well reported.
Yes, strangely. Yeah.
Oddly. And I do wonder, my first thought was, the question I would put to anyone who really knows or lives in Cairo is this a sop in the general direction of the Muslim Brotherhood's deep support, which still exists, even though the Brotherhood is now bound, I believe. You know, if you decide to become the moral arbiter of the nation and start imprisoning writers who might be writing about sex and love in a way that threatens the morals of youth, then you can begin to understand it. It is, as you say, though, Andrew. I mean, you could understand jailing journalists. I mean, the president of Turkey jails journalists from time to time.
Enthusiastically and prolifically.
Although, happily, two of the most prominent were released yesterday in Turkey. So that's actually a good thing. But yeah, he's got, you know, if it's about journalism, you say, oh, well, I understand that threatens the regime. You're going to expose how they go about their business. I don't quite get this unless it is, as I say, a way of trying to reach out to the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood who haven't gone away, even if the
Indeed
Brotherhood
not.
Is banned.
I mean, James, this is a fairly familiar play for a nominally secular military Arab dictator, isn't it? To sort of swaddle himself in Islam and appoint himself the country's religious guardian as well.
Yes, as many others have done before that, but I think it would be wrong to just view this as what that what there is. Sisi is a counter-revolutionary revanchist. He is trying to, bit by bit, put the genie back in the bottle that came out on January the 25th, 2011. And he has done that with the Muslim Brotherhood. He overthrew Morsi, banned the Muslim Brotherhood, putting lots of them in prison, and engaging in state repression. He is fighting back very hard against the young and the sort of young revolutionaries with campaigns of arrest and intimidation and all the rest of it. The labor movement, which was a substantial part in the revolution, has come under attack. But there has been this element that has been quite difficult to put back in the bottle, which is the cultural expression, the social expression, the idea that people can be free because we've demonstrated that we can overthrow a dictator if we all just come together and perhaps we should get better organized next time and not demobilize the popular committees and try to work out actually how we're going to take on the deep state. But still, that level of freedom was still there. And then I think this is a calculated attack bit by bit to cow Egyptian society, to put it back in its supplicant position that it stopped being in when it overthrew Hosni Mubarak.
Michael, again, though, that is also another fairly well-worn page from the dictator's playbook, isn't it? You sort of make an example of a few people who attempt to express themselves to explain to everybody else that they shouldn't express themselves. Al-Sisi was actually quoted as saying last October, the media and the state should not disagree.
Yes, well, that's exactly what they say. I mean, that is the playbook, particularly of and stated in the kinds of terms that would almost be elegant if it wasn't so nefarious. But that is the way things have been in the Arab Middle East for a very, very long time. And I think he rightly understands that, you know, if Syria wasn't disintegrating and hogging all of the publicity or the space for news out of the Middle East, I think that people might pay much closer attention to the way in which this counter-revolution has gone about. Because what people forget is that Tahrir Square really thrilled the world and thrilled young people around the world. And the idea that it's no longer discussed, that all of these basic freedoms that these kids were, I say kids, I mean people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, were enjoying and making and taking on for themselves and for the first time in their lives in many cases, that it should be so brutally suppressed now. And clearly with the understanding of the United States, because they'd prefer stability than anything else, with Libya disintegrating next door as well, it's a shame because it needs to be out there more if you think that there's still a hope.
Yeah. But when it was out there more in 2013, he was still receiving the support of Kerry, of Catherine Ashton. He's still being allowed to support Khalifa Haftar in Libya. Even when there's been very good journalism and lots of scrutiny, still Western politicians have, for those reasons you suggested, gone for the thing that we know, i.e. the sort of dictator, the state is me kind of figure, rather than embracing the more democratic forces, which are harder to control.
Well, indeed so. And finally tonight, possibly staying with the theme of meet the new boss, same as the old boss, FIFA has a new president. Now, disappointingly for those whose work involves reading out the names of public figures, neither Jerome Champagne nor Tokyo Sekwale got the nod. Disappointingly for those hoping for a clean break from the reign of a Swiss bureaucrat, another Swiss bureaucrat did. The most powerful man in football, and therefore arguably in all of sport, is now Gianni Infantino, previously General Secretary of UEFA. Michael, is this about as good a result as might have been hoped for? He said, trying to end the week on an optimistic note.
Well, why don't we, you and I, let's just go through a checklist of who the finalists for the gig were.
Okay, so there's the Salman...
Bin Khalifa.
Salman bin Khalifa, great.
Where is he from?
Bahrain.
Bahrain, yeah.
There's Prince Ali of somewhere else?
Jordan.
Yes. There's Tokyo Sekwale, the South African, not backed by Africa, the South African multimillionaire and former governor of Gauteng province. The wonderfully named Jerome Champagne, about whom I'm afraid I know nothing. And then the guy who won,
Gianni Infantino.
Champagne polled no votes, disappointingly.
The thing is, it went to two votes. It went to two ballots. But the idea is that, you know, this was not, there was no reformist candidate.
No.
I mean, I think Prince Ali of Jordan put himself forward as a reformist. And I suppose he was making the Donald Trump argument, which is, I'm so rich, you can't corrupt me, which is what Trump's appeal was.
Salman's poor, and Tokyo Sekwale is definitely not poor.
I know. See, this is,
I never got the impression Sepp Blatter was scratching about. I know this.
In fact, this is the proof that Trump's argument really doesn't hold. I mean, you can be rich as Croesus and still want more, and you know, clearly FIFA has become a cash machine for the people who run it. I mean, I think that the sad thing was that there was that moment when the reports came out and Sepp Blatter was kind of forced out of his position, although it took him a while to get the message, even after the police arrived. I don't know. You know, it on the one hand, it's terrible. On the other hand, will it stop people watching by the billion the next World Cup?
No. Well, this is the thing that strikes me. It, as far as it's possible to tell, the extraordinary scandals which have swirled around FIFA the last year or so, and it has been one of those stories that when it finally broke was actually worse than everybody already imagined, and people were imagining some pretty extraordinary stuff. But it does not appear to have dented the popularity of football in the slightest. That being the case, what impetus actually is there for FIFA to pull itself together?
I don't think it's going to come from the organisation itself. I mean, it seems, I'm not an expert in FIFA, but from what I've read and the impressions you get, it seems a completely absurd organisation. It seems absolutely ridiculous. I can't imagine it reforming itself in the slightest. I mean, perhaps the pressure will come from FAs and from national sporting ministries, but I don't know. In the countries that I know about, the sports ministries tend not to be the sort of bastions of good democratic practice, trying to make sure that there aren't any dodgy deals.
Well, one of the things that can help, and I argued this when the scandal broke, is twice the National Football League has been challenged by upstart leagues. You know, a bunch of rich guys said, "Well, we can't buy into the NFL. We'll start our own league. There are plenty of good players who don't have a job," and then they get bought out and they bring fresh blood into the organization. I still think that if a reformed world organization is needed, then, you know, either Donald Trump, after he loses his presidential bid, needs to start his own World Cup, the Trump Cup, or something like that has to happen just to compete.
I'm not sure whether the world would rather Trump as president or Trump destroying football. I don't know. I mean, both of them make you weep, don't they?
The trouble is, I think,
we're
really
meant to end on a positive note. I'm sorry.
I know. The trouble is really that sports fans are just the most incorrigible suckers, as can be testified by those of us who got up early this morning to watch a pre-season practice match in the Australian Football League. I think it'll be a good year for Geelong. I'm a bit worried it might be a better one for Collingwood. We will have to leave it there. Michael Goldfarb and James Schneider, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Marcus Hippie is in at 1900 with The Menu, and then Oscar season begins with tonight's edition of The Cinema Show at 2000. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. That'll be 1800 London time. For this edition, though, I've been Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.